true.
Radio. We're broadcasting live on We the People Radio Network. My name is Cosmos. I'm your host, and this is your show for 9/11 Truth Action, the official broadcast of truthaction.org. Tonight we're going to be continuing our conversation with Nick Levice, co-founder of 911truth.org. We spoke with Nick last Friday night, and tonight we will be continuing our two-part interview. When you have to take the viewpoint of a solid third of the country and try to smear it with associations to Timothy McVeigh, you can be sure that your state-sponsored conspiracy theory about box cutter wielding Islamo-fascist is on the rocks. It's on the way out. It's headed for the trash heap of history. And of course, that's what's going on now. The perpetrators of the cover-up of 9/11, all their paid-off corporate minions, not to mention their covert operators, all of them have been lured into direct battle. They're fighting us. They're flailing wildly, desperately. And it's a good sign. We're winning. And we're going to keep it up. I know the folks down in L.A. are going to keep up the heat on Bill Maher. I'm sure they've got all kinds of goodies in store for them, but one component of this is they're going to be demonstrating outside his live broadcast every Friday at 5 p.m. And if you're anywhere in the Los Angeles area, please join them at 5 p.m. this Friday at Fairfax and Beverly to demonstrate outside the Bill Maher show. Bill Maher has succeeded in giving renewed currency to the topic of 9/11 truth, to the topic of the 9/11 truth movement, and to the topic of what did happen at the World Trade Center. And today, a new video has been released, a short educational video on the topic of the demolition of the World Trade Center, which also encourages truth action, joining us in standing up for 9/11 truth. You can find this at the top of truthaction.org right now. I'm encouraging people to not only go there and watch this video, but follow the links to Dig. And if you don't have a Dig account, that's DIGG.com, register there, dig it up. This helps spread the word. Go to YouTube and favorite this video . This will help spread the word . So again, you can check out this new video. It's right at the top of the front page at truthaction.org. I also wanted to just share a little anecdote. You know, what we do here is we promote 9/11 truth action, getting people out all over this country and all over the world into the streets to do public outreach, to do demonstrations, to get visible for 9/11 truth and justice. And it is indeed spreading around the world. Our correspondent from Barcelona was just reporting on his street action from today. He was out in Barcelona doing public outreach, giving out DVDs and flyers. And he said that he was approached from a man from Holland who thanked him for the work that he was doing and said that he'd just come from France where he'd seen a group of people doing the exact same thing. So make no mistake, this is spreading around the world, and I want to encourage everyone listening to please join us as often as you can, getting out in the street, getting visible for 9/11 Truth. Please, please join us on 11/11, November 11th. We take action all together at the same time around the world on the 11th day of every month, and you can see the results of the first 8 months of this campaign for action on the 11th day of every month at truthaction.org. We encourage you to join us. There's also anti-war actions taking place all over the country on the 27th of October. I believe that's this Saturday upcoming. I want to encourage everyone to participate in these. Get visible for 9/11 Truth at these actions, at these marches. Continue the great outreach work we've been doing to the anti-war, the peace community. Let's just keep kicking it up. Let's keep doing it. Pushing ahead. They are on the defensive, and we are winning. On Friday night, we had the first part of our interview with Nick Levice. Nick is a co-founder of 911truth.org. He's a longtime truth activist. He's been involved with this for a long time. He's very knowledgeable on the subject of 9/11. He's got a lot of great ideas tonight. This is the second part of our interview. I'm pleased to welcome back to Truth Revolution Radio, Nick Levice. Welcome, Nick.
Hi there, Cosmos. It's great to be on.
So, what do you think about Timothy McVeigh stuff? The flailing response of the corporate media.
I've been listening to your introduction here, and just talking about the surge in action all around the country to confront the spokespersons of the official story of 9/11 and also the gatekeepers in the media who are doing their best to keep any questions out. And, all I was thinking to add to what you've already said is how important it is at this point to emphasize the essentially nonviolent nature of this movement, because all we're doing, and I mean we're only working with the means that are available to us, is getting the information and the ideas out there. And, this attempt to suddenly turn around and paint it in these violent terms is so clearly, this kind of desperate smear move. And, we've got to, be very upfront with that. This is about freedom of speech and, at most, civil disobedience. If we say we want a revolution, and I'm sure we all do, that's about changing the conditions that create a 9/11 and an Iraq war and, the kind of policies that we have in power. That's not about, there's no point anything like Timothy McVeigh. That would play right into their hands. In fact, that is exactly what they've done. They've been exploiting these actions of the Timothy McVeighs, if they really were of the Timothy McVeighs. That's exactly what we're questioning. Suddenly come out and start talking in that way, such an obvious smear move. And it's really, it might be preparing the ground. We have to be very careful here, and we have to be you know, it's very important even as we confront, these spokespersons of the official story, to maintain a basic respect for ourselves and, yes, even for them. You know, we are being insistent, we are being loud, but, you know, we are not there to do violence. That's not why we're showing up in bookstores or, at the TV studios, you know, and that's just outrageous to bring that in.
I'm so glad that you brought up that point, that this is complete desperation. We know how desperate they are, so, of course, we wouldn't put it past them to try to set us up for anything like that. And I think it's a really good time to reaffirm the nonviolent nature, the peaceful nature of our movement.
September 11th, 1906, 101 years ago, is, you know, when Gandhi kicked off, the very idea of a modern nonviolent civil disobedience campaign. So we have that precedent. That's our anniversary as well.
Indeed, and I think that's significant, that the anniversary of the Satyagraha campaign is the anniversary of our movement as well. And I think that points to a lot of things that we can benefit from learning about. We're part of a long history here. And we're going to take calls tonight. If you've got any questions or comments for our guests, or if you want to call in and give us some action updates, whatever you want, call in at 1-888-202-1984. We'd love to hear from you tonight.
Wow, 1984.
Indeed. So where were we on Friday? Let's pick it back up and let's get back into this.
I think we were, just about there where we were going to look a bit at the evidence around 9/11. And I think it always pays to review it and to keep the basic points in mind. So maybe we could, do some of that today.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. I think this, in the last couple of years, has very much moved to a focus on demolition theory, but that's not usually how I start, because I'm not a structural engineer, and I prefer to move more with the political arguments. Let's just take a look again at what happened on September 11th. This is supposedly the, biggest national emergency on American soil since, I don't know when, the Civil War, I suppose. America is supposedly under attack. Who's responsible for protecting America in that case that it is under attack? Let's see what they did. Who are our elected officials? Who are our officials who are in charge of the defense of the nation? There is a chain of command for defending the nation. It's very clearly laid out. It goes from the president as commander-in-chief to the Secretary of Defense, to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and to theater commanders from there, traditionally, and still in place on September 11th. What were these people doing on 9/11? I find that always to be the most interesting point, because it points to the action of specific individuals that we can question, that we can say, here is something to investigate. We know who they are, and we know what they did. What did they do? What did the chain of command do on September 11th? They went AWOL. They went AWOL with a consistency that cannot be dismissed as full incompetence or stupidity. That's the eternal excuse of this regime, by the way. Of its apologists, I should say, on the liberal side, curiously enough, is that they are incompetent. But the consistency of this incompetence is very telling. We all know about George W. Bush in the school in Florida. And, this is kind of a Rorschach test. What do you see when you see Bush being informed about the second plane crash? Did he have a brain freeze? Does he not know what to do? Is he afraid? This really, first of all, what do you see? I'm curious. Most when you see him hear about the second plane crash at 9:05 in the Florida school?
What do I see?
What's your Rorschach test?
I see fear. I see fear and guilt.
I see something very akin to that. You know, he is indeed deeply disturbed and certainly looks fearful. But what I don't see is a look of surprise. It's very hard to imagine how he could have been surprised, since if you actually look at the videotape, you know, it's impossible to imagine how he was even being informed of anything in the space of time that Andrew Card, his chief of staff, took to whisper into his ear. It's less than 3 seconds. And supposedly he said, now this is Bush supposedly thought the first plane crash was an accident. Supposedly Card said, according to his own account, a second plane has hit the Towers of America is under attack. Now imagine that. You know, what do you even understand out of that? You're just sitting in the classroom and supposedly you've absorbed that. America is under attack. You have no questions. And you sit there for another 7 minutes. And then you get up for another 6 minutes, 13 minutes in all in the classroom without a briefing, without even asking, what did that mean, America is under attack? What do you mean a second plane has hit the towers? It's a completely implausible idea. Now, this entourage of Bush is huge. They're traveling with Secret Service, with the White House military office, with Situation Room personnel, with advisors, with Ari Fleischer and Card. Everyone's in tow. And, you know, they're on their way to the school when they first hear of the first plane crash at 8:46. They're not even in the school yet. They go ahead with the photo opportunity, and they stay 45 minutes in the school right up to the point, live on television. Still they are. And Bush is speaking just minutes before the Pentagon is going to be hit.
We'll pick this up on the other side of the break.
Great.
Yeah, we're back on Truth Revolution Radio, and we're talking with our guest, Nicholas Levice. He's a co-founder of 911truth.org, very knowledgeable on the topic of 9/11. Of course, we need no reminder that this was supposedly the crime of the century, which went without a criminal investigation. And before the break, we were talking a bit about the reasons to question this story. There's thousands of them. And we were starting off with the actions of the people who were in charge that day and how they didn't add up. Starting off, we're taking your calls tonight. We've got open lines. If you want to call in and join us here, 1-888-202-1984. You want to pick that up where we got cut off? You were talking about the ridiculous reaction there in the classroom.
Right, well.
Our commander-in-chief.
The White House has been planning for what to do in case of a nuclear war for 60 years. It's inconceivable that during a national emergency with multiple attacks, they're not taking action to secure the president and put him in a decision-making capacity unless they know that there is no threat coming their way at the school where they can be seen live on television. And I think the actions in the school on that day argue for a stand down of what would have been the normal reaction of the Secret Service and the White House military office and the Situation Room. And, you know, I would argue, especially given what we're going to move on to now, what happens in the rest of the chain of command, I would argue that this is, that the intent of this White House stand down was to have an excuse afterwards. Well, where was Bush? Well, he was in the school doing nothing. He was kind of shocked, and, you know, what was there to do? It was, everyone was still absorbing. It took so long to understand what was happening.
Well, they certainly didn't whisk him out of the classroom, and he's surrounded by all these children there.
No, they certainly didn't.
If the country's under attack, what are they doing?
And again, the idea that he thinks the first plane crash is just some kind of accident when it had already been known at that point for more than 20 minutes that the plane was off course to the FAA and to NORAD, and that, you know, to think that the White House entourage has not been informed, and then to think that, you know, this three-second statement by Card is any kind of information and no reaction to it, again, he doesn't ask, what does that mean? America is under attack. He doesn't want to scare the kids, supposedly. Well, there are ways to extract yourself from the classroom, but don't scare the children. Okay, that's a non-starter. That's a ridiculous excuse. And if you then look at what's happening down the line of the chain of command, you see, what is Rumsfeld doing right then? Well, he's lecturing on the dangers of surprise attacks and terrorist threats to a group of congressmen in the Pentagon, and he continues with this lecture. He continues with his morning meetings and briefings and makes no move whatsoever to put himself in a decision-making capacity. This is particularly flagrant in the case of the Secretary of Defense because on June 1st, just before September 11th, 2001, on June 1st, he had signed an order that integrated him into the chain of decision-making for aerial intercepts, for intercepting hostile aircraft in American airspace. So suddenly he's necessary for making the decision to scramble, at least on paper. I don't really believe that in itself would prevent a scramble just because he wasn't available, but he did put himself in there by his own order on June 1st, and he's not making himself available.
June 1st, 2001.
That's right. According to the 9/11 Commission report, The war room, let's call it, the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon that's overseeing domestic defense and the emergency, the war room is looking for Rumsfeld still at 10:30 in the morning. So he's made himself entirely scarce. Supposedly
Amazing.
he went and helped briefly with rescue efforts after the Pentagon was hit, which sounds noble, but you know what? It's not his job. That's not the role that he's supposed to play. So he's absented himself from any decision-making capacity or any responsibility. Down from him, we have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That was Hugh Shelton. On September 11th, okay, he was on a plane to Europe. So the acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was his deputy, General Richard Myers, who was going to be confirmed as the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff just a few days later by the Senate. And Myers' story is that he also thought the first plane crash was an accident. He went into a meeting with Senator Max Cleland on Capitol Hill, and he didn't come out again until after the second plane crash, and he wasn't informed, apparently, during the meeting. This is his incredible story. He is the head of the United States military, and supposedly he's not informed at all that there's been a second hit on the World Trade Center until he comes out of the meeting, and then he says, someone handed me a cell phone. Someone handed him a cell phone, and he found out that the Pentagon had just been hit. So this is all happening just minutes after he got out of the meeting, supposedly. So he's also successfully, in his story at least, managed to absent himself from any decision-making capacity and from his responsibilities, his duties, on a Tuesday morning when everyone happens to be at work, so they don't have the excuse that it's catching them in the middle of the night. So down from him, we have General Montague Winfield, who it was in charge of the National Military Command Center, the NMCC, which I've also called the War Room, in the Pentagon, and which was responding directly to the unfolding attack in the domestic theater. General Winfield Montague, on the night before, excuse me, Montague Winfield, let's get that right, on the night before, on September 10th, he went and changed his scheduled shift. He was supposed to take over at the NMCC at 8:30 in the morning, which would happen to be exactly when the attacks began. He said he would actually take over at 10:30. So he requested to be expelled for exactly those 2 hours in which the attacks happened. And so his deputy was in charge, a Captain Leidig, who was later promoted to Admiral Leidig. Captain Leidig was in charge for the first time of the NMCC on September 11th. You see this over and over again, by the way, with these absolute first-timers, first day on the job on 9/11 in key positions, which is very curious. So again, and Winfield, it's completely unclear where he was, but you can see him in various documentaries talking as though he was present, but he wasn't in charge. He wasn't in charge until 10:30 in the morning. But he talks as though he was actually at the NMCC during this time. So again, we have, once again, the same suspicious pattern of supposedly, of not being responsible, of not actually being in charge and in a position to make a decision.
We've got all these people who were in positions of authority that morning who've never really been questioned about their actions of that day. And when they have, it's been really, you know, softball stuff. And then even with that, there's discrepancies in their testimonies.
That's right. Winfield was supposed to show up at the last hearing publicly, the last public hearing of the 9/11 Commission in June 2004. He didn't show up. They didn't make anything of it. He didn't even send a statement. Instead, Leidig appeared, and he had a printed statement saying, well, actually, I was the guy who happened to take over 1 minute before the attacks officially became known, according to the official timeline. 1 minute before the hijacking information started circulating through the system, I happened to take over because General Winfield asked me to do so the night before at 8:30 in the morning.
A lot of stuff that just doesn't add up. We're right at another break here. We've got some callers on the line. We'll be taking your calls as soon as we get back from this break. Thanks for holding on. We'll be right back on Truth Revolution Radio.
Gentlemen, we have called you together to inform you that we are going to overthrow the United States government.
You still think that jet fuel brought down the World Trade Center? Does anybody else see a problem here? If the government has nothing to hide, why are they so afraid to answer a few questions? This story does not add up.
We're back on Truth Revolution Radio. This story does not add up. We got a whole lot of things that don't add up. We're talking with our guest, Nick Levice, here. He was talking about some of these things that don't add up, starting with the chain of command.
Well, just to wrap up that point. Just to wrap up that point, Cosmos, and this is point one out of the top 40 reasons to doubt the official story of September 11th, 2001 is published on 911truth.org, a document that I was very much involved in drafting that's still in kind of an outline form. And I think each one of these points could take up an hour or more of radio time easily. But just to try, and we have barely gotten into point one, but just to try to wrap it up as quickly as possible, what have we got here? Bush, Rumsfeld, Myers, Winfield, that's one, two, three, and four, each find a way not to be at the lever of power, not to be in a decision-making capacity. Beyond them, you know, it's also true of Eberhard, that he's also, who was the head of NORAD. He also produced this incredible excuse at one point to a Denver newspaper to the effect of he couldn't be reached because he was on an airplane. He's the commander of the North American air defense system. He can't be reached because he's on an airplane. I mean, that just beggars the imagination. It's just amazing.
Indeed.
How audacious they can be in their excuses, and, you know, what they can rely upon, the other smoking gun here, is the cover-up, you know, that the real questions are not going to be asked by the likes of the 9/11 Commission. Then we have, in addition, who actually was active, what was the likes of Cheney, Clark, Mineta, they have conflicting stories. Clark's story makes a liar of Myers, if you're to believe it, if you're to believe what Clark has to say, because he said Myers was in the loop long before this meeting he was having in the Senate was supposedly over. And Mineta and Clark both make liars of Cheney in terms of where Cheney was supposed to be in the timeline. Clark was in the White House Situation Room above ground, running a situation meeting with the principals, and Cheney was in the underground bunker, the PEOC, the Presidential Emergency Command Center, where that famous orders were issued that still stood, that appear to be stand-down orders for Flight 77 or whatever it was, I know, coming into the Pentagon. So you know, this is just a huge, huge, huge and very deep and difficult at times. But you know what? I actually think it's also very simple. It's obvious, you know, that there was a concerted effort on the part of these individuals not to be in a position to fulfill their duties, not to be responsible for September 11th. They were in the process of letting something happen that they at least, at the very least, had an inkling what was going to happen, and they had a reason, and then they exploited it with every tentacle to get the maximum use out of September 11th. So if you want to give them the incompetence excuse, then that makes it somehow almost more criminal what they did after September 11th when they pretended that, you know, they had a plan, you know, that they were actually qualified to respond to September 11th. You know, through waging this global war and spending trillions of dollars on this military buildup and domestic repression. You know, so you can't, either way, they're cooked, I find. You know, either they were being complicit in that moment, you know, they were each playing their role in pretending to be incompetent, or if they were really just incompetent, then you can't allow what they got to do in these 6 years that followed, which was everything they had ever wanted, everything they had announced they wanted, they had planned for many years before 9/11.
Signed, sealed, and delivered. At the very least, we've got extreme dereliction of duty. And this is what, this is the first point from the top 40 reasons to question the official story of 9/11. And it's a document that's been long available at 911truth.org. We've got it linked at truthaction.org. We want to talk to you. If you want to call in, give us a call at 1-888-202-1984. You can talk with me and Nick. We've got a call from Tom in South Dakota. Let's talk to Tom. Hey, Tom, how's it going, man?
Thanks for coming on the show again. I heard you last Friday and really enjoyed that as well. I wanted to tell everybody I had the good fortune last weekend to be able to go to Boulder, Colorado. It's about an 800-mile round trip. Went down there in my Prius, got about 50 miles a gallon. Sorry for the plug there, but seeing Mr. Griffin talk, it was just incredible. And I just finished reading the Omissions and Distortions book, too, and I want to tell all the listeners, if they want to get more into what Nick has been talking about on this show, get a hold of that book and start with the conclusion, because, I mean, Mr. Griffin is just clearly a very moral man, someone full of integrity, but he's also got a great analytical mind, and I found that book very readable, and there's so much proof in there that we've been had. But one thing I wanted to mention from that show, that talk, was the professor at Boulder who introduced Mr. Griffin and arranged for it all was a math professor. And I'm sorry I didn't get his name. I apologize if you're listening, Professor. But he described himself as a scientist. And he told us in the introductory remarks that nationwide, professors who are investigating the 9/11 issue are losing their jobs. And the one at BYU, of course, is the most famous of all.
Stephen Jones.
Right. But I think that professors or people in academia, not just scientists, but others are being chilled by the threat of losing their jobs. And not just professors, but a lot of people in the truth movement are being chilled. But we have to go for it anyway. And if you hear about anybody who is in a university or a college who's raising these questions and getting heat for it, please publicly support them and privately support them and do what you can, because I think that they can become a powerful ally for our truth movement. And one more thing I want to say is our local peace movement meets every Friday from noon to 1, and we're easily half of us now are 9/11 truthers. So that's been a great resource to kind of get new people in the fold, and, you know, the people who don't want to join us, they're putting up with us and they're hearing us every week. So
that's awesome.
That's what happened to me this week. I had a great weekend, and I'm glad you guys are talking about those issues. Keep it up.
Thanks, Tom. Great work at Mount Rushmore.
Thank you, Tom.
Oh, yeah. I think we're going to be there monthly, because that's the shrine of democracy, and as far as I can see, we're the most democratic people around, so that's where we should be.
May I put in a couple of book recommendations as well, as long as we're doing that? Well, Nafiz Ahmed, The War on Truth. I don't think there's a better academic treatment of really the entire big picture of the history of these connections to this buildup of Islamist terrorism by the United States and Western intelligence agencies, and the case for 9/11, pretty much every base covered, except for the physical evidence. But just a fantastic book. That's Nafiz Ahmed, and he was really the first one out, just 10 months after 9/11, with the precursor book, which was The War on Truth. Michelle Chosnodowski, Center for the Research on Globalization, professor in Montreal. He's got America's War on Terrorism, also a great book. The Hidden History of 9/11, 2001, this great collection of academic articles put together under the Reed Elsevier publishing house, which is a very famous academic publisher. So it's kind of a shock that they got that. You can find all of these, I'm sure, at a site like 911truth.org under the resources page.
That last one's
pricey.
That one's pricey.
It's true, but it'll get cheaper maybe. And of course, the timeline, the 9/11 timeline, which is all available online and constantly evolving, edited by Paul Thompson, with literally thousands of inputs at this point, the largest archive of mainstream and original documentary sources, having to do with every discrepancy, every story really that's been out about 9/11. You will find it at the 9/11 timeline at cooperativeresearch.org, and a whole set of essays, which are often ignored, where he makes the case as well. He doesn't say explicitly what he's thinking, but it's pretty clear where it points. And sometimes you need this kind of sober legalistic case to really get people thinking. It doesn't always work with just yelling at them.
And that was published as The Terror Timeline by Paul Thompson.
That's right.
All right, here we go. It's another break. We will be right back after this short break on Truth Revolution Radio with Nick Levice. Radio broadcasting live on We the People Radio Network. This is the official broadcast of truthaction.org, and we're talking with our guest Nicholas Levice, a co-founder of 911truth.org, very knowledgeable person on the topic of 9/11. And when we talk with a guest like Nick, it really makes me wish that we had more time really to get into stuff. This is actually the second part of a two-part interview, and I still feel like we're squeezed for time. And Nick, I know you wanted to sometime in this show address this disinformation infestation we've got in our movement for 9/11 truth and justice. So maybe now's the time, as we're in our final segment here.
I see. Well, I think 9/11 skepticism and the 9/11 truth movement have had, this is a very long struggle, but there's been an awesome success in the last year. Sometimes I forget it myself. I mean, the very fact of those opinion polls and surveys showing a third or more of the people in the United States, or, depending on what the question is, demanding a new investigation, saying they don't believe the official story, or saying that they lean to some form of government complicity or government orchestration of the attacks. That's our work. That's very much we who put that out there. And I mean we in the broadest sense. There's no one person
the
responsible.
People.
You know, we have really, well, you know, all the people who have insisted on keeping this issue alive and these questions alive and, you know, who've gone out there and done the research and done the action. We haven't gotten to the point yet where it's possible to debate this in a hostility-free environment and develop the kind of case that needs to be developed on both sides, for or against, you know, to truly have a debate in the best sense of a Republican democracy. But we have gotten to the point where the idea is out there. It can't be denied. And we have also gotten to the point where it is being attacked really on a whole new level now with these allegations of, this is potentially violent. You know, the next Tennessee McVeigh may come out. And, you know, the thing about these attacks is not all of them need to appear to be coming from the outside. I'm afraid, you know, we've got, some very obvious examples of attacks from what might be termed the inside. I don't really know, you know, what the motivations of, the people who are doing these attacks, so far only in words, is. I'm not going to speculate about who's an agent. I'm not even going to name people. I'm going to name certain ideas that have been put out there that I think basically serve to discredit. And insofar as you see them being pushed systematically, then there's something going on there. You know, there's some kind of coordination going on there designed to discredit, so that instead of talking about the kind of subjects that we've been talking about so far on this show, we're talking about complete canards, about complete bull crap. And, you know, I think the most prominent recently, the one that's really, cut the deepest has been this entire no planes theory, no plane crashes. There were no planes in New York that hit the towers on September 11th.
Well, it's certainly the one that's being pushed the hardest.
Right. And, you know, there's coordination, there's cross-linking, there's association between the people who are doing it, and there's several very interesting aspects to it that really, to me, show that it is an attack, that there is a kind of cell or cult or whatever the motivation. You know, again, I'm not going to say, and I couldn't possibly know who's an agent and or who's crazy or know what's in anyone's heart.
Could you outline those?
Mind. Well, okay. I would say, you know, there are several very interesting things about this no plane crash idea. First of all, it tends to argue against the very idea that evidence even exists. If people, any kind of evidence, it's kind of like this postmodernism gone wild, where if people in New York City say, I saw a plane, well, then they're liars or they're deluded. If it's on the video, well, then the video was faked. If it's on amateur video, well, then that video was planted. If there's debris around the World Trade Center or pictures of debris showing, that's from a plane, well, that was planted. Someone was running around planting the debris on top as though this would even be necessary for an inside job conspiracy. What does this accomplish? Absolutely nothing. Anything that anybody says, you know, if there are relatives of people, you know, who say they saw somebody on the airplane, they're liars too. This has an enormous alienating effect, and that's how I think you can spot it. It's an attack on evidence. It's corrosive to evidence, and it's corrosive to people who we should be reaching out to and wanting to ally with. It's corrosive against the alienating of the people, of the very people who have the most reason to question 9/11, the victims of 9/11. And it creates a kind of general stink bomb effect. And then here's the other big tip-off about what I believe is going on here. When, you know, the same people who are pushing this idea of no planes in New York City and a set of related ideas, when they at the same time attack everybody else. Now imagine that you really believe this. You know, you would think you were in a very special place historically, and you would want to approach it very delicately in convincing people, well, actually, yes, really, the video was fake, and let me explain to you why. But no, instead what they do is anyone who doesn't immediately parrot their line You know, that's already the crime. If you don't already repeat this absurdity that they're saying, then you're already criminal, and you're already and you're going to be called an agent. You're going to be called part of the 9/11 plot. You're going to be called a 9/11 perpetrator. And then if they go ahead and call for your death, you know, if they call for violence on you, what are they saying? This combination, this attack on the evidence, this alienation of groups that would be our natural allies, this stink bomb effect that makes everyone think the whole issue is crazy, and then this violent rhetoric directed against all other activists. Everyone is an agent except the people who have who carrot at all times the no planes in New York City line. You know, this, put it together, it's coordinated, it's a cult, it's cross-associated, whatever word you want to choose for it, okay? We're not trying to make a case here for who's COINTELPRO, who's a government agent, an infiltrator, an agent provocateur. We don't know. We don't know that for sure, or who's crazy or who has some other motivation. Maybe they just want to sell books, whatever it is. But we can see when the action is corrosive and an attack and coordinated, that is the obvious part in it.
And these efforts do seem to go hand in hand with the efforts of the so-called debunkers. And I think it's just becoming more and more obvious to more and more people.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of like one serves up the bait for the other, you know, and they reinforce each other. They tend to get the information that they distribute from each other. The debunkers are always thrilled. Oh, look, new wars among the truthers, you know, they'll say. Check this out, you know. And then there's like a whole other circle of people who are enabling it out of whatever motivation, maybe entirely innocent, maybe entirely naive, you know, who are just saying, oh, let's not argue. You know, let's give everyone their fair hearing. Well, if you're going to give a fair hearing, that means you can also come to a judgment. If you've come to a judgment that there were plane crashes in New York on September 11th, 2001, then you don't have to go over and over and over and over again on the same thing. That case is done. And, you know, that's a problem, you know, when there's kind of this big tent philosophy of, oh, you know, everyone has something beautiful to contribute, even if what they're contributing is to throw a metaphorical battery acid on the whole cause, which is what's going on here. So I think people need to wake up to this and, you know, to really be as rigorous as they can possibly be, and also to be a little bit more minimalist, to understand that you do not have to do the 1,000-page dissertation. You do not have to hit every point. What you have to do is shoot down the official story and show why there is evidence for complicity. Use the strongest points. Use the points that you know 100% you can document and confirm and show to be true. And use, you know, the most logical arguments. And, you know, you will get a lot further with it than if you just say, well, you know, let's just allow all research to be equal. Because it's not. It's not. You know, that's not the meaning of a truth movement.
And again, a great tool for doing this is that top 40 reasons to question the official story of 9/11, which you had a large part in producing, and that's available at 911truth.org. We've got it linked at truthaction.org. Nick, thanks so much for joining us again. I hope you can come back again. I'd love to talk to you more. You've got so much information and a great perspective. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you very much. It's been great. I guess we can talk again some other time. You take care, man. You're doing a great job.
Thanks, Nicholas. Take care. All right, we'll be back on Friday night. Truth Revolution Radio. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9 p.m. Pacific on WTPRN.com, the official broadcast of TruthAction.org.